Hi, this is Pragmatic Dave Thomas. You're listening to the... Oh my God, I just... Help me out here. Agile what? Uprising.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I am this episode's host, Jay Hursko. Joining me is fresh back from his international trip to parts unknown, James Gifford. Gifford, how are you?
What's up, Jay? A little tired, a little jet lag.
This is going to be a fun one.
Well, stomach's still not quite right either, so I'm going to run out in the middle of the podcast and crap my brains out.
Fair enough. We can always edit it in post. So the topic of tonight's episode is domain-driven design and how it's applied to agile transformations. So first off, let's start off by, for our listeners, if you're not familiar with domain-driven design is a methodology typically used in architecture for designing complex systems. And there are a couple of key concepts that are used along with the definition of domain in order to visualize how these systems work. So let's start off, Gifford. Do you have experience using this sort of stuff either in your current life or your past lives? Have you come across this idea before?
Well, if I remember domain-driven design, I think you and I were at a large financial institution that hired a company that, you know, rhymes with, BotWorks. and they were helping us build a loan platform using domain-driven design, which really meant they broke the system up into a whole bunch of different pieces and then connected it together with duct tape and bubble gum, and took a lot of time to really deliver things.
Right.
And that's, I mean, the idea of being able to break up and compartmentalize systems so that they're independently updatable and connected by common messaging, it's a great idea. But really, you know, it takes a lot of, you know, I think it took them a lot of effort to figure out how to make it all work.
Right. And we're going to touch on that a little bit, how it's almost needlessly complex. It's like the equivalent of shooting yourself in the foot because you're creating so many little pieces tied together that it can create way, way more problems longer term when it comes to maintenance and upkeep. So let's back it up and start with the basics, right? So there is a book. I forget the gentleman's name. I want to say it's, what's his name? The guy who wrote the book on domain-driven design, Eric Evans. And there's a simpler book, which all of you could download. I'll post the link in the show notes on InfoQ titled Domain-Driven Design Quickly. And what it does is it distills the book down. And the first thing this starts off with is the definition of a domain. So the definition of domain, if I'm plagiarizing from either this book or Wikipedia or wherever I saw it, is a sphere of knowledge, influence, or activity. The subject area to which the user applies a program is the domain of the software. So Gifford, in your example, we were building a loan platform, right? So this was the domain. And then below that, keep me honest, we had the idea of subdomains, right?
Yeah. So there was like an account one. There was a bunch of them. There was like a user profile, basically the customer profile, the various accounts, payments.
So there almost were, like features.
A whole bunch of them. There were like 10 of them.
They're almost like sort of software features or business capabilities is probably the better term. And all these domains all tied together into a master domain, which we then built a whole shit ton of software for. So let's talk, James, let's start talking with concepts. So there's a couple of key concepts that I took away when I read this book, and I've actually been able to apply them not only to my current role, but the transformations I've done since. So the first one I came across, which I think is really important, is bounded context. And to our listeners, when you think about bounded context, think about the setting in where something, the definition of context is the setting where something appears and determines its meaning. In terms of what we're doing, think about not something as rigid as an old euphemism, the Chinese wall, but it's where parts start and stop. So if you look at And James, I'm going to just use a large enterprise company as an example. The business they're in really is of no importance. So in that domain, you have multiple different domains. Like you said, there's customer support, there's account setup, there's billing, there's payments, there's finance, there's HR. Each one of these is a domain, right? The concept of bounded context comes in is you need to know where each piece starts and ends. So this becomes really important when you're even trying to plan out something like applying a domain to a value stream, right, or a business capability. You need to know where one starts and ends. And with that, that becomes helpful with identifying constraints, and it becomes helpful with identifying dependencies. So when you're crossing from one context to another, you need to make sure that there's a clear demarcation there so you understand where the pieces end, so you can understand how they fit together better. Now, based upon your experience, James, where does some of this bounded context stuff come into play, even in your current life, like so one of the transformations you're working on now? Have you run into things where people don't know where I stop and you start, or where my responsibility ends, and have you seen it run into problems?
Well, yeah, you know, to some degree, I mean, I've seen, you know, various groups, you know, depending on the functional silos within the organization, you know, suppose you have the, you know, a requirements engineering group, and you got a QA group, and you got a software development group, and you're really trying to get those guys together, and all of them play a specific role within the organization. They all have specific job functions that they kind of do. It's interesting when those people all start going, well, you know, I like what these guys are doing over here, and I'm going to meddle with that because I think I can do it better. And they end up meddling with when you get the guys, the requirements engineering, where some of the product owners come from, like, well, we know about this Agile stuff better than the Agile coaching group. So we're going to muddle around and try to make that, we're going to get in there and mess with that because we know better. Instead of us all working together in harmony.
And you just brought up an interesting topic by using the word, by using the word handoffs, right? So would you agree that that's a sure sign that you're making things a little bit too complex if you have too many handoffs, too many subdomains inside of a domain? Is that like a good warning sign that maybe we need to simplify this?
Oh, you mean when I've got a 36 teams to deliver on one set of capabilities for a particular product group doing their own thing and waiting for the next group and basically overrunning your project budget? I've never seen that at all, Jay.
but I mean, you bring up a valid point, right? So here's another Agile principle writ large when we talk about cross-functional teams, right? So when you have an outside or an oversized amount of handoffs or an oversized amount of subdomains that you're trying to make workflow in between, that's a good sign that you're suboptimal in your setup, in your organization structure. And you probably should look at maybe getting to more cross-functional idea. And while there will still be bounded context, it'll be less rigid and easier to step across those pieces.
I mean, I think that the picture you're really trying to paint there is when you're trying to run an Agile organization when you're still just stuck with component teams.
Yep. Yeah, that's basically where I'm trying to get to, right? It's
but you know, you can go Agile if you read the book Scrum from the Trenches by Heinrich Nyberg in a weekend.
Which when it was emailed to all the employees, it bogged the Outlook server because it was a 16 meg attachment. It was a lot of therapy to unwind that, man. I don't want to go back down that path. Next key concept here I want to talk about. Is I think this, it's everybody, and this is important even if you're doing waterfall, right? Ubiquitous nomenclature. So the idea that when we say ubiquitous nomenclature, we really mean a language, right, that's structured around the model, but and everybody uses it. And I think this is important. So I'll share with you, James, an anecdote. Back in my waterfall days when I was a BA and project manager, I was working on a project. We were doing some tweaks to the marketing engine. And I had two marketing guys in the room. I had two data science guys in the room. I had a couple of UI developers and a couple of ETL guys. And we literally spent, I think it was a month and a half, an hour or 2 hours twice a week trying to get the requirements out. And we came to realize in week six that the fundamental stumbling block that we were having was three different people in the room were using the term project to mean three different things. The data science guys, they were using the term project to think about one of their data analysis packages. The PMO types like myself were using project to think of the whole initiative. The marketing guys think of project as almost like a marketing campaign, but they bleed and overlap with each other. It was nuts. And when we finally had this light bulb go off, and I'm not going to give myself credit, there was definitely somebody in the room who said, you realize we're all using the same word to mean three different things. And when we were, and then that took a whole nother set of meetings to iron out what the right words were. But once we got reached that point, it made life easier because we all understood we were saying the same thing. So in my personal opinion, James, and you let me know what you think. When I think of transformations, right, when doing the agile, right, we need to all agree on what is a value stream? What is a business capability? What is a product owner? What do they actually own? What is a program? All these sort of things are very, very important. We have an episode coming up where we're going to talk about the definition of flow and the flow manifesto that I saw a coworker come across. Coworker author, I should say. I think these things are important because if everybody's speaking different languages, it's almost like you're building a Tower of Babel inside IT. What do you think?
I mean, I have to agree with you. I mean, that's the whole point of orchestration in a lot of these systems, and you see it in design, you know, domain-driven design, is that, you know, if you look at it like an event bus or any other system where they're using orchestration, you're basically having one system talk to another system, and it doesn't care what the other one system's saying. By the time it gets to the next system that needs to use it, it's transformed into, you know, something that's readable by the users at the other end of the other client. You know, we use these kind of techniques. So we, you know, everybody's familiar with safe PI planning. Well, we use a version. We basically took that practice. We've adopted it. But we don't, you know, it's, you know, our PI, we don't plan for 10 weeks. We don't do 2 weeks of innovation planning. But we use that concept of getting everybody into a room. We only do it for 5 days. So instead of us calling it PI planning, we call it, we have every practice that we bring in from the outside, from another framework that we modify to fit the context of our company, we rename it so that we are talking all the same language. Because if you bring people into the organization, they hear that you're doing PI planning and it looks nothing like that, then they're like, well, this isn't what we used to do, or this isn't how I used to do it. So to eliminate all that confusion, we've renamed anything in the industry that we've brought in and made our own so that we are speaking that common language.
So you say when you bring it in and you make it your own. So if you're bringing something in wholesale without any change, do you keep the industry standard name, or do you change it to something else?
No, we keep it wholesale. I mean, if it's wholesale, brought okay. in, pick it up off the shelf and use it like a hammer, you know, it's still called a hammer.
That's interesting, because when I talked to Ivor about
crescent wrench, I'm gonna call. You broke up there, buddy.
We're both clipping a little bit. When I talked to Ivor, he was talking about, you know, the methods prison and sitting behind a guru and, you know, creating all these unique terms. But I never thought about it in that way, the way you just described, where I am a new person walking into an organization and I hear PI planning. I automatically assume it's 3 days, it's co-located, you have the giant arts and crafts board with all the red yarn. So I think there's something to be said there about renaming it and making it your own, especially if you changed it.
Yeah. It helps keep the context. It now creates a new context around practices because the spirit of it's there, but it's changed.
So there's another practice here, James, which I want to ask you if you're using it or seeing another concept. And there's the concept of a context map, right? So this is, it almost combines that bounded context and the domain itself into like a visual cue. So you build out this, I've seen it done like almost like a thought bubble map, mind mapping. But have you had a lot of experiences where you actually draw out the context itself to see not only where it's tied together, but where it overlaps?
So right now, we're doing our lean agile journey in various products. So we basically go into a set of products, we transform all the teams within that product, every product's its own self-contained thing, but there are four consistent things that live within that product. There's product and program manager, or there's program management, there's functional management, there's the teams, and when I loosely say teams, I'm talking about the context of the product owner, scrum master, and the development team. So a scrum team, we use agile teams because we use the same construct around that for Kanban as well. And then we have our product management group. So we have this four-way construct. So as we address the journey, every single one of those basically role families have their own journey on our agile journey. They all at some point in time come together and converge at various points where the knowledge that we need to teach them and they need to grow towards. So like that when we reference that, I just mentioned that idea of the modified PI planning that we've run. We don't even introduce that to the teams for a long time. We get them just doing regular releases and planning a release basically using Scrum foundations and a little bit of story mapping. And so everybody's learning that knowledge. They can go off in their own knowledge tracks and learn. But after they get those skills down, then we would bring them we ultimately, all of those different domains or paths that they're following converge to basically then evolve into a shared set of practices. And if our whole entire journey map, there's probably eight or four places where everybody intersects and we touch the full set. But everybody else, throughout that though, they have their own individual knowledge sets that they're learning and able to kind of mature and grow on.
So you just said something, James, I want to pull on that string. So you said each particular group has their own journey map, right? So there's the overarching journey and what you're trying to accomplish. But you actually do go through the steps for, say, certain business capabilities or functions or value streams, whatever. Each one of them has their own, what amounts to, I don't want to say the dirty word, maturity model, but they have their own plans in place about how they're going to get from A to B vis-a-vis maturity.
Essentially. So, we talk about teaching teams to iteratively develop software. So what we're doing is using a maturity model essentially to help teams incrementally grow. So we have our journey starts out with a gathering. So basically it's a product onboarding. There's a whole bunch of stuff that we do, training, and then each track goes out onto the journey. And so the teams, we're really focusing on building some level of proficiency around, the Scrum framework. So we might look at, we go from starting to modeling. So we don't use numbers. We go starting, what does it go? It's starting, learning, understanding, modeling, and then embodying is the fifth of it. So by the time you're at stage five, you're super knowledgeable. So we set kind of learning paths and learning checkpoints. And basically, so for this stop, we're really trying to get teams to about this level of maturity before they can move on to the next stop. And then at that next stop, we would, basically continue to improve their Scrum skills, but now we're going to introduce the ideas of work in progress limits. So they're starting to get the feeling of going through that rhythm of Scrum. They're going to fail a little bit. They're not going to make sprint commitments, different things, but they're going to be mature enough that, all right, we can now start getting them to think about WIP limits. And so the next time they're building skills around improving Scrum while introducing some WIP limits and getting some basic skills around that. Once they master those, they go on to the next spot. And you're iteratively, continuously building up sets of skills while introducing new practices that ultimately let them deliver more efficiently, because we're running a Scrum plus model. So we basically run pretty much pure Scrum with lean practices added. And as they evolve, if you're in the Agile team, basically track, once you've evolved past the, you know, basic like Scrum and lean principles merge together, then we start really getting into some kind of technical practices and things like that. So your learning journey is iteratively introduced, so you're not overwhelming people and teams, but you're also able to track progress. So now the entire organization can see how that team or within that product is actually progressing on their journey.
Oh, very interesting. Very interesting. So we've walked away a bit from context mapping, but you introduced the interesting idea of creating a, it's almost like a plan and then a sub plan below it. It's, you have a master goal and transformation journey here for the enterprise, but then for each individual piece of it, they're all on their own separate ways. And I know we're eventually going to have a show coming up on Agile maturity models, which I know is a hot button topic lately. So I don't want to get too far into that, but that's an interesting way to look at it. Never thought about it that way.
But I mean, if you want to talk about a context map, let's look at something like, I went to a customer, we did a large e-commerce platform. We did a story map of just, here is the ordering workflow. Within the ordering part of the system, there were 18 nonlinear ways to actually get into the ordering basically flow. So whether you were in inventory, you were in some reference data screens, you were doing some just straight up coming into the shopping cart and shopping. So we took that story map and we turned that into a user journey map. So it basically created all of the different contexts. So I'm a user coming into the ordering experience from the inventory module while I'm doing this activity. So you're basically looking at that context map of, I need to be able to have a consistent experience from going from this one part of a system into the next part of the system. And this data should be kind of riding along with me as part of that experience.
So let me ask you this, James. When you did that analysis and you realized that there are umpteen different ways to enter into this process, after you realized that, was a decision made to cut some of those back to make the experience more uniform? Like, how did you handle that?
So we ultimately went and did, so we invited a user experience group in. We ran some customer simulations, and what we agreed on was ways of working within the product. So basically we identified, if you were displaying data, it needed to be in a grid, and it was this type of, like, if I'm gonna do editable versus read only versus sort filter, we basically created reusable content, like basically reusable JavaScript. I think they were actually using Angular or React, I can't remember, but we made reusable components. So literally every single page that they had to deal with, they understood what the work context of that screen was. And then we just used elements from the library. And then every 6 weeks, we'd have customers come in and play with it, because we weren't releasing it for a full year. So it was basically a big bang release. But every 6 weeks, we had customers come in and play with it and validate the work experience. And so the user experience was bound by you would say we ubiquitized the UI elements by creating this specific ways of working within the product. So every developer just had to know, hey, what's the context of the customer doing in this page? And then I can go to the library, Bob, plop them on the page, find an object, Bob's your uncle, the thing was off to the races. So it helped accelerate the development of the application too, because we weren't having to rebuild content or rebuild pages from scratch every single time.
Literally, right. Just,
so you had a complete team running through the whole thing.
And I'm assuming it also made maintenance going forward easier because the code was by extension cleaner, less onerous. You knew that when you made a call to look up the payment history, it was the coming from the same piece, no matter where in the app you did it, where in the system you did it, you were hitting basically the same service call.
Yeah. Same service call, same UI. So in reality, when we looked at customer support and service screens, the customer support was literally looking at the experience that the customer had on the screen. And then on 3/4 of the pane, on the other quarter of the screen was more the technical mumbo jumbo-y, like data-y customer service kind of thing. But they could literally see what the customer saw in the support side of the application. So if you're on the phone trying to trouble something with the user, you're looking at their cart. And then you could see some more of the data, like some of the more detailed like data kind of things. So it made the experience extremely well for the, you know, people trying to support this too.
Oh, fascinating. So you've actually presented the perfect segue for the next concept I wanted to talk about, which is the context of aggregates or aggregate routes. So in pure semantic terms, an aggregate's an aggregate route is a collection of objects bound together by a root entity, right? So this is everything is tied together to the same root. So that means to your example, right? Everybody's hitting the same UI piece for the service. Everyone's hitting the same shared resource. So then this way it's less confusion. It's less things get screwy and get out of control. Another way I look at it is specifically when it comes to aggregate routes regarding a transformation, it comes down to vision. It comes down to the why, not technical, but this is also an aggregate route. What are we trying to accomplish in terms of this agile transformation? What does the end state mean to us? That, if you think about it, is the aggregate route that all the other subroutes spill out of, because okay, so if our goal is to put a man on Mars and return him safely in the next 10 years, every single sub department, every single subdomain can look at that and say, okay, this is my goal, this is my route, this is where we're all boiling down into, this is what I need to get to. Does that make any sense at all, or did I just go a little bit down the nerd rabbit hole?
You've gone full on nerd. But you know, I'm trying to, let's see if the internet's going to cooperate here for me. But I mean, I think that you're right. And so, you know, David Marquet talks about, you know, to create empowerment, to create, you know, different, like basically that autonomy, be able to decentralize decision-making, teams need the clarity and the technical competency to kind of be able to deliver that. And so, you know, leaders are critical to whether you're a product person and creating the clarity around the what the product's doing, how this particular product fits into the company mission, all of these various areas and opportunity for clarity. I mean, if none of that all doesn't roll back up to what the company's mission is, then you kind of, you know, you're creating that self-defeating prophecy. And there's a quote that I'm trying to kind of find, because it's something that we kind of see and we wrestle with kind of regularly. And if I can find it within the next 2 seconds, I will tell you what it is. But so here it is. So this comes from the book Hit Refresh by Satya Nadella. When we are an inch apart on the strategy at the leadership level, our product teams end up miles apart in execution.
That's brilliant and spot on.
So, I mean, so organizations create clarity. Like, it's kind of ironic whenever, you know, I've worked at some companies where if, you know, we were going around the room and talking to leaders within a room, and when the organizational dev guy was up there, you know, doing his song and dance and the pageantry of you know, the greatest showman, essentially, because that's their training style, they brought up, what is our company mission? And I'm in a room of 30 leaders. And two of them could tell you what the company mission was.
Oof.
How are the people in the trenches delivering on what the company mission is? How do they know why I show up every day to work? If I had to tell a friend, why is this company so awesome to work for, you should come, if you don't understand what your company's mission is.
Yeah, that's a bit terrifying. What was the end result of that? Like when everybody realized that there wasn't a universal understanding, what was the outcome?
I mean, the outcome, I mean, there has been repeated kind of tries to kind of get people aligned around this mission. And I can tell you they never totally got it right. There never was that clarity, whether people didn't care, people didn't put it front and center. Like it takes a lot of effort to remain aligned and not get lost. And some people don't, you know, some of these messages don't wrestle or resonate with people. And, you know, it's kind of, they let themselves get confused. Some of that, I posted something in one of our Slack channels, I think it was, about forced confusion. They don't like what they're hearing. they'll inevitably make themselves confused to avoid the topic at hand.
Which is, that's a whole nother can of worms for a whole nother podcast. James, I think we've quickly hit the 30-minute mark, and I think I've covered off just about everything I wanted to touch on. So any final thoughts on this before we wrap it up?
You know, I think that there are a lot of valuable ways to look at domain-driven design. If you're looking at a holistic transformation and you're looking at all the subcomponents of an enterprise, from HR to the business, I'm thinking that there is, you know, we talk about, you know, rest in peace, Mike Beadle. When we talked about when we interviewed him for the manifesto designer stuff, he was talking about business agility and talking about, you know, making that leap from, you know, the traditional Scrum guide Scrum to a version of Scrum that was ubiquitized. He basically took all of the concepts of Scrum when he was doing. Oh crap! What was it? Is it Enterprise Scrum?
It was Enterprise Scrum.
So when you look at Enterprise Scrum, you know, Mike went through and they kind of very carefully ubiquitized Scrum so that it didn't matter whether you were in development, the business, HR, executives, you could figure out how to apply that in your day-to-day lives. So, you know, or it within the context of working in the company. So as we go to look at all these different domains within our company, you know, as coaches, as leaders, are we looking at making this as simple as possible for the adoption of others? Or, you know, are we trying to kind of come in and use all kind of rigid terms and different things that aren't going to resonate with different people? So that's, you know, it kind of goes back to some of the earlier opening stuff around, you know, we took PI planning and we made it our own and we renamed it because everybody else coming in is going to have that, you know, different context, just like your story about, you know, everybody thinking a project's different. You know, it is these concepts are powerful if applied in the right context. You could turn this idea, these notions, into something really powerful and probably a semi-decent way to get to business agility. But you're going to have to think about it. You're going to have to, but I think there is something there around, you know, giving people context. And that was something that was awesome that Mike did, was he gave people the context without necessarily talking about the software aspects of it.
Right.
He created that map. So, you know, I think that this is something I'm going to probably keep thinking about a little bit more as I kind of mess around with things, because I think, you know, while we're focusing on product teams right now, eventually that, you know, our company's goal is to get to business agility. And so how do we integrate finance? How do we integrate, you know, legal? How do you integrate HR? You're gonna have to move past the development, you know, because we use Pure on Scrum team, traditional software kind of terminology. So, you know, as we look to expand that and bring these concepts in, you know, maybe these different domains, because they are very, very cut and dry domains in the organization, you know, how do you bring them in so that you have a unified language across the company?
The and I don't want to go too far into it, because I think we're going to have an episode about it. But if anybody out there has read Project to Product by Dr. Mick Kirsten, he talks about the idea of work items being universally defined. And he actually, I think it breaks it down into four categories. There's features, there's risks, there's defects, and there's debt. And his argument is, if not everyone has the same concept of the work being done and then the weight applied, the importance of each, it's really easy for, like you said, if you're an inch off at the leadership level, you're a mile off at the team level, it's really easy to lose sight of why do we need to stop this iteration and concentrate more on tech debt and risk when we should be doing new features. It's a whole different discussion for another episode. So James, I'm going to wrap us up. First of all, thank you for your time. With all your jet lag, and your wonky GI tract, I appreciate taking the time to sit with us. On behalf of James and myself, I want to thank all of you listeners for tuning in once again. If you like what you heard, please give us a review, a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, your podcast app of choice, I believe even Spotify. It does help others find us. There should be a thread about this on the Coalition, coalition.agileuprising.com. So feel free, hop in, join the discussion. If you've used domain-driven design, never heard of it before, are you going to try and use it now? Jump in on the conversation. We're always looking for dialogue. Also, to remind our listeners, we do have a Discord server, which is discord.com/agileuprising. There's been some lively discussion there as of late. And lastly, but not leastly, we are all fully committed to keeping Agile Uprising free. However, if you would like to contribute to offset hosting costs, server costs, all the incidentals, we do have a Patreon as well. So you can look us up there as well. So once again, James, I want to thank you. I want to thank all of our listeners. And until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.